Good morning. Welcome to something. It's the Roundtable Panel on this Wednesday morning. It is the 10th of February, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. I hope you are having a good morning, and if you are not, hopefully we will make it better. If you are having a good morning, hopefully we will not make it worse. Let me introduce the panel to you before I do that. A reminder that you can always join in on our conversation, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind this morning. Obviously, we'll be talking about impeachment, and we'll get to that in just a moment. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. It's been a great day so far. Nice sky. And, you know, we're all, you know, prepared for a good day. Yesterday was a good day, too, at the start of the impeachment trial, but I guess we'll get to that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, we will. Lecturer, adjunct professor in communications for SUNY, New Paltz, and RPI, Terry Gibson is with us. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm happy to be here, doing just fine.
Well, good. Excellent. Always wonderful to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time out. Investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you.
You sound suspect. Yeah.
You always put me on with all these cheery, happy people.
Well, we just lost Rosemary. I don't think she. Anyway, that dropped. But
we'll have to make a change in our attitude. She's quite right.
She'll
quite
be back.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, if everyone's happy, including Alan, then maybe it's on you. Let's see. Bob Griffin is with us, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob Griffin. How are you?
I am doing well, Joe, and I am praying to the radio gods that I am more cogent than Bruce Castor was yesterday.
Well, good luck with that. Yeah, it is a low bar. It is a low bar. That's right. Yesterday, of course, was the opening day of the Senate impeachment trial, and the weakness of Trump's case was on display. Representative Jamie Raskin, the Maryland Democrat leading the prosecution, opened with a video montage showing both the January 6th attack and Trump's words during that day. Raskin later delivered an impassioned argument recalling his own experiences. "All around me, people were calling their wives and their husbands, their loved ones, to say goodbye," Raskin said. "Senators, this cannot be our future. This cannot be the future of America. We cannot have presidents inciting and mobilizing mob violence against our government and our institutions because they refuse to accept the will of the people." Trump's lawyers condemned the attack on the Capitol but said Democrats were pursuing impeachment out of partisan vengeance, and they argued that making a former president stand trial would establish the precedent for any other former official to be punished at the whim of the party in power. "This is nothing less than the political weaponization of the impeachment process," David Schoen, one of the president's lawyers, said. But the performance of Trump's lawyers received mostly dreadful reviews, even from Trump himself, who was furious while watching the proceedings from Palm Beach, Florida. My colleague, several of Trump's Senate allies, including Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, criticized his lawyer's case as ineffective. Bill Cassidy, a Louisiana Republican, called the prosecutor's case focused, organized, and compelling. "President Trump team was disorganized," Cassidy added. "They did everything they could but to talk about the question at hand, and when they talked about it, they kind of glided over it, almost as if they were embarrassed by the arguments." One Republican congressman asked what his issue was with the Trump defense, and he said, "Did you listen to it?" So, we begin there. Alan.
Well, first of all, this was a terrible effort on the part of the Trump lawyers. And why? Because they don't have a case. I mean, you know, there is no case that they can make. They couldn't put on a video montage because what would they show? The Democrats did a terrific job, And, you know, all I got to say is I was blown away by what they were saying. I just thought that there was nowhere to go for the president, who, of course, is still trying to make an argument that he was deprived of the election. And that's why he apparently lost the first legal team he had hired, because they wouldn't do it. And these guys wouldn't do it either. So, of course, you know, you had the president criticizing them for their presentation, but their hands were also tied.
Well, and people now wondering just how long they'll last, if they'll last even through the trial. Rosemary.
Okay, so I feel a little sorry for them. They have a difficult case. They have a very difficult client. They had no time, and they're on a national stage. So I can see that they're nervous and disjointed. Don't get me wrong, I thoroughly enjoyed that the ex-president ended up being embarrassed, but it was kind of painful to watch them. And I would be completely sympathetic except for that poem. What was that poem? And he read the whole thing, 82 stanzas, tears in his eyes. I don't get it. And yeah, they're in trouble. I would point out that he doesn't have a good case, but there are arguments that could be made in the president. We didn't, for the ex-president, we did not hear them yesterday. And the two lawyers said, well, you know, we didn't expect this. We thought we were going to just argue constitutionality of impeachment. So I'm looking forward to today to see if they can pull it together and make an argument. Maybe it's free speech, for example, and try to do something for Trump.
Bob Griffin.
You know, if you're listening and you're confused about what we're talking about, take the 13 minutes out of your day and watch the video that was presented yesterday as evidence. And if that doesn't both shake your confidence in D.C. and make you angry, then I don't know what does. I watched that video and I thought, if this isn't an impeachable offense, I don't know what is. I thought the presentation by the Democrats was well thought out. I thought it was they presented a very cogent case. I thought that the poem was very strange, but then I kind of thought that maybe what they were trying to do was take a page out of Biden's swearing in ceremony where the poem was so well received that, you know, that they thought, okay, well, we'll give that a try. It's impossible, though, Joe, to watch that video and not realize that we have elected officials, even in our own area, who are supporting cop killers and traitors. I mean, there's no other way to defend our politicians who are so feckless that they will not do the right thing and hold Donald J. Trump responsible. And I'll make this as a final comment and pass it on to Terry. But, you know, if they aren't going to impeach him, then he should be arrested. If the argument is that, oh, you can't impeach him because he's out of office, then he should be arrested and he should be charged.
Terry.
Well, I certainly don't feel sorry for Trump's lawyers. They did, after all, sign up for this. Nobody's
That's
forcing
right.
them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it reminded me of students that come to my public speaking class and don't do their preparation, don't do their homework, don't do their research, and try to stand up in front of the class and fake it and hope that nobody notices. And you know what? We noticed. They were not prepared. I mean, how could they not have anticipated what the Democratic strategy was going to be? What did they think they were going to talk about? I thought the Democrats did a spectacular job of laying out a very concise argument, and it's exactly what I would think any decent lawyer would have anticipated that they would do. So the fact that they were caught off guard by that, to me, just goes to show you know, how just incapable these individuals are, and it is going to be interesting to see what they do moving forward. But I do think that video that they played, and as I understand it, they're going to be playing more videos and maybe even some footage that hasn't been seen yet, just very, very effective and gut-wrenching to have to relive that all over again.
How about the the vote to actually go with the trial. I mean, it was mostly among partisan lines, but there were some Republicans that said, okay, I think we should go forward. I would assume, as dismal as the day was yesterday for the Trump defense, that no minds were changed here on the panel, that this the outcome is still a foregone conclusion, right, Alan?
Not mine. You know, look, I think these people are in a terrible spot. They know these things are going to be made into ads. They know they're going to run them against them. Everybody in a Republican district is, and which is, by the way, why four Republicans have decided not to run, I think. That's a big part of it. And by the way, I just can't help but say how much I loved what Terry said about the unprepared students standing up to give their speeches, because that's exactly what it felt like, I thought. So extraordinarily correct. No, these guys have made up their minds. The only way to save themselves is to vote no on impeachment. And there's going to be tremendous amount of pressure on them.
You know, and Joe, if I could, I think, Alan, I think you're spot on. I think the reason we're starting to see so many early declarations of senior GOP senators deciding not to run again is the fact that they realize that they're in an untenable position. I mean, but you look at that video and you start to think back to what used to be sort of core principles of the GOP, and you realize there's nothing left. You know, and the whole position is so bloody bankrupt that it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing watching, you know, even Cruz and Lindsey Graham sit there and contort themselves trying to figure a way to defend the undefendable. I'll also note that I thought the as I was watching the initial comments from Trump's attorneys is that, boy, if this doesn't sum up this guy's career, I don't know what else does. I mean, the dumpster fire just continues.
Although there were two telling moments. One was the when they were running the video and the senators in the room, the Republican senators such as Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and others were looking down at their papers. They weren't looking at the video screens. They were talking to other people. They weren't paying, you know, they weren't looking at the screen at all. And I thought, wow, that says a lot. But then they were doing the exact same thing as Trump's defense started. It's like averting their eyes. I can't look. Susan Collins saying, I thought at first it was complex, and then I just realized it was confusing. But ever the dreamer to think that it was complex, I guess. I don't know.
You know, Joe, one thing that occurs to me here that makes it so difficult for Trump's lawyers is that Trump is just wrong and evil on this thing. And no matter how you put the lipstick on the pig, you are still confronting the fact that right and justice is on the Democrat side. It seems pretty simple to me.
Well, and apparently, Rosemary, the thing that really ticked Trump off, according to Maggie Haberman's reporting, is the first words out of the defense lawyer's mouth is...
I'm the chief prosecutor.
But also that the reason they switched things up because the case that the Democrats made was so good.
Yeah. And then also, he also made the point that the same one that you guys just did, that if you can't impeach him, then come down and arrest him. His own lawyer is saying that. So, yeah, I'm not unaware of how bad they really were. But still, it is an axiom in American tradition that we keep saying we need to uphold that even the most guilty deserves a defense. And so those two men stepped in where a whole bunch of other lawyers did not. So I can't completely condemn them. Although now I want to go to Nebraska, you know, that judiciary, that judicial thinking place.
By the way, we should mention the poem. We're getting some letters on this that The poem was Longfellow. It's not like the guy made up his own poem. It was Longfellow that he was reading, and so we'll. But it was a rather
tort- yes, it was Longfellow. But what the heck did it mean? What did it have to do with insurrection at the Capitol? You guys are smart. Can you explain it to me? I'm not a poetry lover.
There is an entire.
And so I said, okay, this must be me.
There's a great article in the Washington Post that goes through the history of the poem and how it was used, how it was even used by Lincoln, and how they completely misread it. Also, there are alternate endings to the poem because Longfellow was just always working and did various versions that completely turn around exactly what he was saying at the end. So. If you care that much, there is a really good article in the Post about it. For what
it's
worth.
Thank you. That's my homework.
There you go. Janet writes to us and says, "I read that the conviction depends on the vote of 2/3 of the senators present, and that Republicans could just leave the room, changing the numbers required to convict. Is that right? Seems like it would offer a way out for some spineless Republicans to not vote." For or against. Well, if you don't show up, you're voting no, right?
Absolutely, I mean, Joe.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And if you think that president will take that as okay and not say, okay, this guy screwed me over,
right.
and therefore I'm going to run a primary against him, you'd be wrong.
Well, Marco said he had a dentist appointment. We'll get him off the hook.
But I love these letters that are saying they just don't have to go. Yeah, if they don't go, they're as guilty in Trump's mind as if they vote no, if they vote for impeachment.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. I have a lot of letters, and I'm sure we'll get more. We'll continue on this discussion as we talk about impeachment trial day one, and then think about what happens today and tomorrow, and the schedule has been laid out, so we'll go over that as well and talk more about this subject and introduce other subjects into the mix as well. We will continue right after this short break. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo are with us, and we have your letters, so let's go to those because we have many. Sue says, the reason why the Republicans are confused is because they know the Dems presented a compelling case. It's factual and true, and Trump's side did not. Dave says, I keep hearing that GOP senators need to be convinced. Ridiculous. They need to get paid. They only vote, shouty caps, for personal gain and job security, no matter how short-sighted or damaging it is to the government, insurrection, or the world, climate change.
Joe, and let me ask it this question to the panel, if I could. You know, do you think folks like Cruz and Hawley, part of the rationale for really trying to bury this thing is their own liability? That if actions are taken and Trump is found guilty, what happens to them? What's next for those senators that actually also participated in the insurrection?
Right. So do you just ignore the whole thing? I mean, that seems to be what they've been doing all along, right?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely crazy, this idea of waving our fingers and pretending that it didn't exist. And it's also really interesting. I saw this in one of the newspapers, so I apologize. I don't remember which one was. It noted that like the folks that ran the Benghazi investigations into Hillary Clinton, 5 years, 5 years of constant work, even when she was out of office. And now some of those same people are arguing that this shouldn't move forward. So, I mean, there's just this level of hypocrisy that's just absolutely galling.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But the problem with it is that, you know, if somebody who's been an arch conservative or who has been on the wrong side all of a sudden turns, there are an awful lot of people who say, oh, that's good. That's good. The only way they can save themselves is to turn now. And as these numbers, these polling numbers get worse and worse for Trump and for the impeachment effort, I suspect that you may see some of them turning.
Rosemary?
To save themselves.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm sitting here trying to think of what exactly the pressure is on these poor people. They have closed ranks. Trump is likely not to be convicted. And if that happens, I can't see that Hawley or anybody, really, anybody else will be held account. There's some talk, but it's only among diehard Democrats, about getting rid of the insurrectionists who wanted to support the big lie. But I'm sorry, I don't see it happening. And yes, of course, it's full of hypocrisy, but we're not surprised by that either. I mean, Merrick Garland and what happened with Amy Coney Barrett showed the extent of Republican hypocrisy, and it is immense. And we talk about the pressure on all these Republicans to support Trump because of his base, and yet at the same time we're talking about how turned off everyone is. It just seems like there's no way out of this that I can see, unless there's some prosecutor somewhere who will have the approval of people in the Justice Department, which also seems like a long shot, and would go after Trump and Hawley and the rest of them.
We got this letter from Doug, who makes this point. Despite the abysmal recitation, at $2,000 an hour, the defense attorney probably earned more money reading the poem than Longfellow earned for writing it.
That's funny, but good luck getting paid.
Yeah, that's right, whether Trump will actually get paid or not. We got a sarcasm alert from Ed, who said, I am completely convinced by the defense lawyers in the impeachment trial. I am so grateful that they're defending my constitutional right to vote against Donald Trump in all future elections. We then go to John. Okay, indulge me for a minute. Let us collectively dream that 17 Republicans find their backbones and vote to convict the former president. Would he have any legal recourse to contest the resulting ban from running for political office? Also, would this dreamy ban just apply to running for federal office or from running for any political office? Thank you for your continued insight and passionate discussion, says John.
Well, there is
no appeal from conviction or from impeachment. Yes, he could bring a case, but it would be so linked with the impeachment, which is clear in the Constitution, he would lose it. I don't think that's really viable. And it is all offices, as I understand. You are not allowed to hold a place of public trust. So that's even dog catcher. That's local office, too.
Larry wants us to back up for a minute and says, what's more disturbing, the 13-minute video the House manager showed of the mob attacking the Capitol at Trump's urging, or that nearly all of the Republican senators still didn't want the trial to continue even after seeing it? Bob?
Oh, yeah, boy, that's an excellent point, because they go hand in hand. And watching it and being outraged and feeling that same anger that I felt on the second it feels like a long time ago, but it really wasn't that long ago.
So, Bob, what would you do to, if you were them, to save yourself?
Them being a Republican senator?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think they can save themselves now. I think that they're in a position where if they're going to stand up and actually be a profile in courage, that their political careers are over. But I also think that if they don't stand up, that their political careers are over. I think there's a lot of people in Congress that need to start thinking about what their next job is going to be. Mm-hmm. Now, it's going to take some time, but I do think that the enraged electorate that we saw with this past election is going to continue.
I'm not so sure you're right. In the red state, Bob, in the red state, Trump at all costs states, if you vote to convict, you're done. No question about it. Mm-hmm. But if you vote to support the ex-president, there will be, and we see this in the polling, there will be an awful lot of people who will say, well, he did what was right, and he supported our president.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, Alan. There was really interesting numbers coming out about the loss of Republican voters. And that's a trend I think we need to keep an eye on, that the Republican Party really really could be condensing itself into just this the crazy Trump wing. you know, and that's it'll be interesting to watch how that shift continues or if it continues.
Terry?
Well,
oh, go ahead.
I'm just going to say that go ahead, Terry, please.
I was just going to say that this unconstitutional argument is, I think, what will save many of them. It's what they're using as cover to go back to their constituents and say, well, look, you know, it's unconstitutional. I can't support something that doesn't fit our Constitution. And I think that argument, as lame as it is, will suffice for many of them, especially those that are in very red districts. So I know where Bob's going with this, but I think I think that many of these senators are still in very secure positions, and they will still have enough support there to keep them in office. And I think that that it's going to be elections ultimately that will turn the tide on this. But I think that's a process that may take 20 years because of a lot of variables, including redistricting, which is coming up very soon. So
not in the Senate. You can't redistrict
the Senate.
But there are the marginal purple states, and we do see four people getting out already. So I suspect that some of them are looking at the tea leaves and saying, you know, if you're in a red state, as you just said, you're fine. But if you're in a purple state, or if you're a state where you have actually contested elections, it's time to run.
So another way of asking the question of yesterday's vote, where six Republican senators decided to vote that the trial was constitutional, should we read anything into that?
No.
Okay. I agree.
Go
ahead, Alan.
Go ahead, Alan.
I think you can read into it that there are some people with principles. You know, there are some people who just say, this is just wrong, and I'm going to – Mitt Romney, I think, is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah.
He has some cover. He's going to get reelected, although he's just reelected. There are some people in this world who do what's right and will be recognized for it.
You know, I think that they had mixed motives yesterday. I think Romney and Collins will end up voting no or yes for impeachment. But Cassidy, who voted essentially a procedural matter that, yeah, they can continue, I don't think he's going to vote for impeachment. I'll be surprised if he does. And then he gets to go back and say, well, you know, I listened to the argument and I was willing to be swayed and I didn't. So I don't know yet. I'm holding off until I see that final vote, which I fear will still be most of the 50 Republicans voting to protect their man.
Rosemary, following up on what you just said, are you pretty sure that Collins will do as you said, that Collins will vote for impeachment?
Yeah, she's got like 150 years until her next election, so she can vote her conscience for a while, and she's trying to build up her cred as a moderate. So, yeah, I see her voting for impeachment. Trump can't really – I don't think Trump can really hurt her. I don't think he can hurt her. So, yeah, she's made the calculus that she can vote for impeachment.
One could take the exact opposite point of view, which is because she has so much time on her ticket to ride – that she will take the chicken way out, which she has always done.
She's disappointed us in the past.
Yeah. What'd you say, Rosemary? I'm sorry.
I said yes with Susan Collins. I can't rule that out, which is why I say I'm holding off judgment. I could see her, Murkowski, and Mitt Romney voting in favor of impeachment, but Ben Sasse, who voted for continuing, do you see him voting against it? He's in trouble if he does, for sure. Cassidy in Louisiana, that seems like a suicidal blow. I don't know.
You know, when you take a look at what Trump has done with his own vice president, you know, and all that other stuff, if you take somebody like Sasse and you say, well, you know, he'd be in trouble if he did this, his ticket is already punched.
Yeah.
With Trump.
Yeah, the vilification of Mike Pence is really it is really one of those sort of stunning sub stories to this whole thing. I do think the point that was made that the easiest way out for senators was yesterday's vote to say that it's just not constitutional. That would have given them the ability to say we don't support the insurrection, we don't support the death of police officers, you know, this is just about the law. And so yesterday's vote was the easiest vote that they are going to have.
Let's take a break. When we come back, go ahead, Terry. Go ahead, Terry, and then we'll take a break.
I was just going to say that this is just one of the many faults in the impeachment process, and that it's ultimately a political process, and politicians look for cover, and they develop the constitutional argument to give them cover, and it's one of the things that really makes this different than what a legitimate trial looks like.
We'll take a break.
I want to know what happens now that the cover is gone. So go back. When you come back, I want to hear you talk more about that.
All right. We'll do that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo make up the panel this morning, and we welcome your letters as always. So let's go to some of them because we have quite a few, actually, and I want to get to them. Let's see. Rich writes, is it possible that many Republicans did not vote yes for the procedural vote to move the trial forward was because they did not need to? That is, since a simple majority only was needed to move the trial forward, these Republicans are waiting until the important convict vote to vote yes. If they vote yes now, the former president could apply pressure until the convict vote. What do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, what will be a news-breaking story will be if someone who voted that it was unconstitutional decides to vote to impeach. That's going to be a bold move, but I don't think you're going to see that, because how do you vote to impeach when you've already voted that it's unconstitutional? That was the whole point. That was my cover argument. Once you've taken that vote, you've given yourself cover to not have to vote to impeach.
So if you're not voting to impeach now, do you have any cover? Do you just say, I think you voted wrongly and partisan, and I'm still not going to go along with it? Is it still a workable cover after yesterday's vote? That's my question.
Yeah, because it's an individual vote, just like all votes are individual. I was given the chance to vote yes or no on this, and I voted that it was unconstitutional. That's my assessment. And therefore, you know, we can now have an argument about whether this is or isn't constitutional. We don't have to argue about whether what Trump did was a crime, because it was unconstitutional, the process itself. So I think it's cover if you take that vote. That's the way I look at it. Just like any vote is considered part of your record. And that's just my perspective, of course.
All right. Well, that's why you're here.
Terry, I think you make some really good points there. So I appreciate that argument. So the argument now is that they're going to continue to vote no against impeachment simply because they're going to defend it as that they still believe that it was an invalid vote to begin with. So rather than take the merits,
you're
going
to have to.
Go ahead.
Yeah. How do you go back to your constituents and argue? I mean, you'll have to be willing to go back to your constituents and argue, well, I did vote to impeach, but you said it was unconstitutional. Yes, but you have to have an answer to that. But so they'll need that if they decide to go against the president.
We go to Doug, who says the mainstream TV news network CNN, MSNBC, BBC repeatedly placed the bulk of the blame on the dissemination of Trump's big lie upon internet companies. The larger issue are the right-wing propagandist TV networks, Fox News, OAN, Newsmax, etc. A large portion of older adults who support the Republican Party get their news from TV, not from the internet. Plenty of blame to go around, isn't there, folks? Go ahead,
Bob. There is so much, and I think one of the more interesting potential discussions is going to be what's constitutional free speech. I would argue that what Trump did is the absolute equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater, going back to the Supreme Court case. But this argument that he has protected speech here is I think one of the sort of the other subplots that's very interesting to talk about.
Tim writes to us and says, hey, can't they vote with secret ballot? Alan?
Oh, God. Okay, I'll do it again. No. No. Stop it, will you please? representative means you have to know how your representatives, the person who's taking your place in the House of the Senate voted. You can't say because of convenience we have to let them vote anonymously. It's ridiculous. Please. I mean, we're getting all these letters on this. It seems so clear to me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see it.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, imagine what our country would look like if no one ever had to be held accountable for their vote. It would just destroy our country. They have to go on record. That's the whole point of electing someone to represent us.
Gene writes to us and says, it is really very simple. The First Amendment does not bar the prosecution of someone who shouts fire in a crowded theater or who incites others to violence. Tim,
well, that's the question. That's the question in the trial. That's what's going to be the issue. Was he really doing that? Was he really yelling fire? Of course he was. Now, I know it, and I think people on the panel know it. Porky Pig, what do they used to call them? Or Bugs Bunny? Anyway, those people, that's almost as good as Wordsworth's poem, that literary reference. But they're scoundrels, and they are going to do what they have to do to take care of themselves. No question about it. And they'll make any excuse they can.
Tim writes to us and says, go ahead, Terry.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's one of the things that's so frustrating about this is that ultimately, no matter what Trump's lawyers do, even if they're just the worst possible lawyers you could ever imagine, in which they're kind of looking like they might be, that they're still ultimately going to prevail. You know, the bar is set so low. And these Republicans are going to stay together, and they're going to vote in a manner that protects this president and protects themselves. And it's just really sad to watch.
Tim writes,
rascals.
Tim writes, as Trump is saying that the mob attacked on their own volition. The mob says they acted on instructions from Trump. One can anticipate that Trump will ultimately deny, blame, and disparage his base, a Judas to the constituency he claims to so love. Then there is Rita, who says, I agree with Rosemary. It was painful, and I have sympathy for Trump's lawyers who have nothing to work with, nothing wrong with a little empathy.
Yay, they took the job. They didn't have to take the job. This guy's a miscreant of the worst kind. And rather than, you know, I mean, that's the traditional thing, that everybody deserves a lawyer and that everybody under the legal system deserves to be defended to the best of the defense's ability. Yeah. But they took the job.
Yeah. And, you know, and there's no excuse not to be prepared. OK, I understand that they may not have a lot to work with. You know, that old adage of, you know, if you've got the law on the side, you bang on the law. If you don't, you bang on the table. But this idea that they just didn't appear like they were ready to go. I mean, all I had to do is listen to the show. I mean, if you listen to the show a couple times, we have laid out on multiple occasions what the argument is going to be. I mean, it was no secret. That's why it was so stunning that they were so unprepared.
Well, listen, it isn't just a matter of preparation. I get that. But it's a matter of competence. These are not top flight lawyers. We've talked about Trump's inability to attract top legal talent. So you've got second string going up against, oh, my God, great prosecution managers from the House. You can't help but feel sorry for them. To use Terry's student analogy, there are some students who are just try as they will, good intentioned as they are, they're just never going to put on a good show. And that's what I felt like yesterday, that Trump really has very people who are not competent for the job he hired them for. And
you'd think with the $500 million that he siphoned off his supporters, that he could have bought better attorneys. just a note.
It's also important to
Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz came out yesterday.
He was on Newsmax yesterday.
Yeah, saying
he was
that,
on Newsmax criticizing this.
Correct.
So why wasn't he in the Senate arguing for it? Now Dershowitz would have put out an argument that was, he certainly is theatrical enough, he could have done it. Those are skills I don't think those two guys did. So where was Dershowitz? If we're talking about grandstanding and wanting to help Trump, he has all. I don't get it.
He turned down the case. Yeah, he was asked.
Yeah.
He turned it down.
Yeah. That's exactly.
So back to the homework analogy that Terry used, Witt wants to just add a little bit more and saying that listening to Sean yesterday, I did turn to my wife and say it sounded like a ninth grader doing a presentation that he or she prepared the night before by pasting together encyclopedia excerpts. It was hysterical.
But, you know, he had a really pretty cover that he colored before he handed it in. So,
you know, you get points for that.
The lack of content.
You know, one word, Bob. Glitter.
Glitter.
John says, as reprehensible as the Capitol insurrection was, Trump in his speech never explicitly advocated violence. He came close, but never actually did it. That's why I always thought the House should have drafted. Let me finish the letter, and then you can go off like rockets, I promise. That's why I always thought the House should have drafted a second article of impeachment about the direct pressure Trump applied to election officials to overturn the result in multiple states, but particularly Georgia. There is evidence of this. Why didn't they draft such an article? Okay, go.
Quote, fight like hell. You got to go down there and you got to fight like hell. What's that?
You can't be weak. There were, and that's what the real brilliance of that film yesterday was. They put his words next to the action by rioters who were quoting Trump. So the fact that he didn't explicitly say go fight, I think that's wrong. Certainly, it's arguable. And as for the second count, we're seeing Georgian officials that just opened a criminal investigation. Well, they say it's an investigation, but it could lead to criminal matters if you can get past the Republicans in the Georgia legislature to go after Trump for what he did there. And that's I prefer seeing that there because, like the rest of you, I prefer criminal prosecution to impeachment. That's where you have some real bite.
We'll pause, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue with letters, we'll move on to other topics, and we'll hear from you. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. First News with Ray Graff. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo are with us. We welcome you and your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let us go to some letters here. We go to Corinne, who says, I keep hearing the panel say that we have this principle that everybody deserves a lawyer. That's only true when someone is charged with a crime. This is impeachment, very different.
I still think he's got the right to legal representation.
Absolutely.
Let's see. Then we go to Donald. Give these guys a break. They had 2 weeks to prepare. There's a reason the other lawyers quit. Trump's actions were indefensible.
Well, that's right. Trump's actions were indefensible.
Enough said.
And the lawyers didn't have to defend him. But they chose to do it, and now they look like some bad.
Well, I mean, Ari Melber, who's the newsman with law training, says that there are arguments to be made. Those guys didn't make them yesterday, and it was because they were caught flat-footed. They said, oh, we thought we're only arguing constitutionality today. You'll hear us tomorrow on everything else. So I do think we have to wait. It's just wrong to say, however strongly we feel against Trump, that there is no argument to be made on his side.
House managers are...
Rosemary is exactly right. She's absolutely right. There are multiple arguments can be made, whether you agree with them or not is a different story. They just did not rise to the occasion. They did not do the job they were hired to do. So they have really failed their client. And as happy as that makes me, I still think that, you know, as we've said before, that people are deserving of representation. And it'll be interesting to see how they move forward.
Do you think they got any sleep last night?
I wonder whether they make it through the trial, too. Do they get fired before the end of the trial?
I hope they got their money up front.
I was thinking of their spouses who must have had to make them feel better and give them a drink and say, no, no, honey, you were fine. Oh, I would have hated that job.
Doug says it's easy to see why Trump can't get better lawyers. What lawyer would want to work for someone, A, who regularly refuses to pay those working for him, B, who will require them to mount a defense that will destroy their careers? that Trump was reportedly disparaging his lawyers while watching coverage of his trial yesterday is pretty telling.
You know, I don't know about that. Think about it for a second. You think, okay, some lawyer who represents a heinous killer and loses because it was so clear. Well, then everybody else who needs a lawyer who will defend them under the most trying of circumstances will say, hey, get that guy. You know what I mean?
Yes. Anybody else?
Rosemary?
Nope. I've had my say. Thank you.
You're not getting suckered into that one.
John Wright.
That's a tough one. I will note, though, that last time I saw Rudy Giuliani was on a milk carton. I mean, talk about somebody who has absolutely disappeared.
Well, I heard that he started a radio show. Is that true? He started a radio show.
No, he does have a radio show. I think that's right.
Yeah. So,
bring it on, Rudy. We're ready for it.
If you miss hearing Rudy, you can tune in.
Yeah, anybody can have a radio show.
Well, that is very true. Painfully true.
I think it's on right now.
Yeah. That's right. He goes up against us. Rosemary is hilarious, says Ann Kennedy. I just wanted to add that. I don't know what she was laughing about, but okay. As Republicans as the Capitol insurrection was, let's try that again. As reprehensible as the Capitol insurrection was, Trump in his speech never. Oh, I already read that one, didn't I? Okay. My apologies.
We get it,
and
though.
And it's still wrong. That's
yes,
still wrong.
That's right. Well,
even though you read it twice.
Yeah, reading another time isn't making it right.
Polly says, once again, it's falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater. Jeesh, says Polly.
Thanks, Polly. I got it. Yeah. I mean, if it's a real fire and yell fire, no, you're not going to get in trouble. So I appreciate the correction.
I think Alan agrees with you, yes.
There was Alan's good mood. I can hear Alan's good mood just slipping away.
Yes, Trump's lawyers are right. Impeachment is a weapon, a defensive weapon designed to protect us all. Of course, it's being weaponized in that matter. I agree, says Robert. Clarence,
that's a really interesting point. Is that I mean the intent of impeachment, and if you look at the framers' thought process, it is a political process. They admitted it's a political process. They admitted that that it isn't a typical legal process in sense of how most other cases are taken. So I think the letter writer is spot on. So this idea of saying, oh, it's just partisan politics. No, it's political for a reason. This is the way that the founders tried to balance the separation of powers so that you didn't have the courts, you know, being able to step in like we see in some other nations and, you know, arrest legislators or arrest the executives.
I think that both the public and Congress has it inexorably mixed up, the political and the legal. In his first impeachment, we heard, oh, he didn't commit any crime, as if you have to commit a crime to be impeached, which you do not. And this time we're hearing, well, what's the crime? He has free speech. I think it's all mixed up, legal and political, and the founders did not make it explicit because they never thought we'd be in the position we are today, where it's the president of the United States exhorting a mob to go after the Capitol. And there's no clarity from the Supreme Court, as there has not been for many of these constitutional issues, because Trump's the first one to have challenged them.
Yeah, and it was as noted. I saw a couple of interesting articles that noted that the first impeachment was almost too esoteric. You know, that it wasn't concrete enough. And now this one is too concrete. It's sort of like, you know, is the third one going to be just right if the first one was too soft and the second one was too hard?
The
Goldilocks defense.
No,
exactly.
Bring in Goldilocks. All right. A couple more letters and then we'll move on to other stuff here. Also,
you're just anti-bear. That's all.
Anne wanted to clarify her comment that Rosemary was hilarious about the consoling of the spouse comment. So So we know that too. So Rosemary knows why she was hilarious.
I know, I'm a hoot.
forever a hoot. Yes, Rosemary. Clarence says, yesterday's hearing reminded me of three wise monkey proverbial principle. The three wise monkey proverbial principle. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Instead, there were 44 people with votes of see no truth, hear no truth, speak no truth, then vote no truth. That is the summation from Clarence. Then Pamela writes to us and says, I'm really hoping that the pro-impeachment people hammer home the danger to the Constitution. It's not about punishing Donald Trump. It's about holding the executive, legislative, and judicial branches to a standard. How about phrasing the argument from the point of view of pro- and anti-democracy? Pin the anti-impeachment people on the authoritarian petard.
I love that word.
Petard, yeah.
I mean, I think so. I still go back to the fact that, you know, his words led directly to multiple deaths. I mean, you know, you think about it, he fired that crowd up, but he didn't fire the crowd just up on the 6th. He fired that crowd up even into the summer when he was already forecasting to people that, you know, that it was going to be stolen. To me, still some of the stronger arguments is what the crowd did by listening to his words. And I thought one of the interesting pieces in the clips that were shown yesterday were some of the insurrectionists sitting there, you know, actually talking about how they're following Trump's direction.
Well, I think that was a good letter too, but the Democrats, I think, are addressing some of those issues. I mean, they are talking a lot about the fact that, you know, there can't be a January exception, that this can't be acceptable behavior for the executive branch. I mean, they certainly are going after Donald Trump, but I think they're also talking about how if they don't take action now, then future presidents in this office will be given an exception.
You know, it isn't just the future, too. I think the TV commentators made a really good point that there's a whole lot, which I did not realize, about this insurrection that we still don't know. We do not even know how that officer was actually killed. We don't have that information. We don't know about funding. We don't know about a coordination. We don't know about the meeting with Trump. There's a whole bunch of it. And I really am looking forward. That's why I'm going to be watching, because I want to see if we're going to get answers to some of those questions.
Great points.
All right, let's move on to other stuff if we can. I think we're
before we do that, Joe.
Of course,
the one comment that Rosemary just made about funding, I think, is really important. People mm-hmm. need to remember it's not inconsequential to put that stage up and to do all of the production that went into it. That's an expensive event.
The bulletproof glass.
How did they get to Washington? The Washington Post has a story today. They analyzed
that
these people are all in financial difficulty. Many of them didn't vote. They don't. They've had bankruptcies. How the heck did they afford a trip to Washington? You know what that cost?
Yes, and that's where I do hope that the Justice Department continues to dig into this, because it's there's some dirty money here.
And I mean, part of that was the wasn't some of that linked to the public's error that a lot of the money came from? Am I right on that?
Oh, the
I'm sorry,
error
like, oh,
no. Of the Publix is in a supermarket. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. But I think some of it was also I thought it was linked back to the campaign, but I would have to go back and see if I could dig that up.
You're right, Bob. There are links between the campaign and that rally. And, that's what I want. I want links to Trump money.
All right. While we're talking about attorneys, let us go to this story, that the Biden administration is asking for resignations from Trump-appointed U.S. attorneys. They asked on Tuesday the remaining U.S. attorneys appointed by President Donald Trump and confirmed by the Senate to submit their resignations, sparing only two federal prosecutors who were conducting politically sensitive probes, including a President Biden's son, according to a Justice Department news release and various officials. The resignations will not necessarily take effect immediately. The U.S. attorneys were told on a conference call that they would be allowed to stay until February 28th and transition out. people familiar with the matter, said that the move generated some criticism from both sides of the political aisle. Illinois' two Democratic senators, Dick Durbin, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Tammy Duckworth, said in a joint statement they were disappointed that they were not consulted before the administration asked for the resignation of Chicago U.S. Attorney John Lausch, whose office has been pursuing a corruption case that has raised questions about a powerful state Democratic lawmaker. Alan.
Well, I'm all for it. You know, this is traditional. You know, you put people in place who have your confidence, and, you know, knowing what we know about Donald Trump and who and kicking out some of the best prosecutors in the country, of course it should be done. No two ways about it. I don't care.
Bob?
I sort of have mixed feelings. Part of me longs for sort of a little bit more, you know, cooperative effort, and I think they could have rolled this out a little bit slower. Actually, what surprises me a little bit is that they didn't wait for the confirmation of Merrick Garland and before they did that, so that he would have an opportunity to weigh in. I read the articles and the comments from Durbin and Duckworth, and I think they're valid. At the same time, though, I will note a couple points we can't forget. Trump had an abysmal record of appointing people with any degree of competence, and so many of his positions were purposely left unfilled so that he didn't have to go back, or his appointees didn't have to go back and get Senate confirmation. So I think this is something that if it had rolled out over 6 months, it wouldn't even been an article. The fact that they actually took a stand and said, you know, we're going to do this, is a little bit questionable, but at the same time, the end result is the same, and that's where Alan's final point is right.
Hey, they can always put the Chicago guy back in. It's not like this is traditional, not just for attorneys, but for other jobs too, where everybody resigns, the whole board resigns, and then you can get your job back. So I do think you should have paid attention to Duckworth and Durbin. They know what they're talking about on his party. But on the other hand, I wish you would be able to more easily clear out other federal agencies, starting with the post office, and that it looks like that's going to be a bear, that the only way they can get rid of DeJoy is to reconstitute the Board of Governors. And this is another case where Obama's appointees were not allowed to be heard. And so Trump appointed really essentially all of them, even the Democrats on it are so conservative that they might vote not to remove DeJoy. They're the only ones. And the president allowed only to get rid of them for cause. That means there has to be something they did really incorrect or incompetent connected to their job. So it's going to take some really smart lawyers, not Trump lawyers, real lawyers, to figure out how we can go after that. I think he needs a clean slate. I think you're contaminated if you're touched by Trump.
I want to talk about the post office for a second, because I know that a senior official in the Obama administration has been elected to the Board of Governors. But as you point out, Rosemary, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there, and that's going to take a lot of time. It's they shook it up. They shook it up good, and it's going to take a long time before it turns back.
Hey, Rosemary, do you know why they shook it up the way they did? I mean, it's obviously we're having consequences
Trump
now.
Trump has had a hair up, as you know what, about the post office for years, and
which
he
one?
Targeted it. He did this on purpose.
Yeah.
And so DeJoy, meanwhile, is in there, and he continues to be, he calls it cost cutting, but he's pulling the place apart. And the people, the American people, support the post office. This should not be happening. And yet, by the rules, it may be really difficult for the Democrats, and even in charge, to turn that around quickly. DeJoy's going to be there.
This wasn't just Trump. If you look at it, the GOP has been going after the post office for decades. In part because it was such a strong union, a public union, which is one of those points that the GOP really doesn't like. So this isn't necessarily new. I will also note, though, that I personally think that he was put there with the intent purpose of making sure that it was as difficult as possible to get mail-in votes on time.
Absolutely.
and that this is part of that overall conspiracy to rob the American people of a fair election.
I think you're right.
All right, let's go. Terry, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
No, I think I'm in agreement with everything I'm hearing. So I'm just
You're happy. That's
for
good.
An opportunity.
All right,
fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, good. Bill said, Rosemary said she didn't know how the police officer was killed during the riot. It's been widely reported that he was injured by a fire extinguisher that was thrown by one of the thugs. But we don't know who, where, when, why, how, right?
Yeah.
Still a lot we don't know.
That is correct. There's no criminal charges. There's no, we don't, it's not the level of knowledge about the death of a public officer like that you would expect. And as I say, I was surprised when I listened to this yesterday because I thought, oh yeah, I know how he died. But we don't have the details yet.
Rob says, as you were changing topics, and I will admit that it's right before break, so Rob got us at a good time. Can the panel please explain to me why miscounting the nursing home deaths in New York State is being made into such a big deal if, in fact, they were actually counted? What difference does it make where they died? They died.
It's all they got. You know, yeah. the thing about the Republicans is in New York State, which is now an official endangered species. They'll do whatever they think they've got to work with. And this one had legs, and they're going to continue with it because, you know, they don't have anything else.
Yeah,
oh boy. I want to dispute that.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
What happened was a cover-up. It wasn't so much that a policy by the Cuomo administration resulted in really it was a bad policy for nursing homes to be required to take in patients. And then he said, okay, he wanted to reduce the seeming impact of that bad policy, and he allowed people count it. Not as deaths if they were seriously ill, and so they shipped him out of a nursing home and put him into a hospital. So it made it look made his policy look less bad than it really was. Now, that was at the time, I don't even blame him for that. And the truth of the matter is there's not that many more deaths. And it isn't as if the death count was undercounted. So all that Cuomo had to do was say, I made this policy, you know, with the best information at the time. It turned out to be a mistake. I'm sorry. Instead, he covered it up. He lied about where the numbers were. And then he looks bad because the attorney general got those numbers. They were not hard to get. She got them. And that's why he has made it's a self-induced error. And Cuomo has done this before with not giving out information that's public and it should come out. And he looks way worse than I think he really ought to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm struggling a little bit with this, though, because the deaths were still counted. It was just that where the deaths are.
But that's why it was important, Bob, because his policy created a dangerous situation in nursing homes. Very dangerous. You're putting people with COVID into a population most at risk to get it. And indeed, there were many deaths because of that. This was diluted when the deaths appear to be in hospitals, not in nursing homes. It totally covered up the error of his nursing home policies.
Well, I'm going to agree with Rosemary on one point, and that is it was a mistake. The way that it was handled was a mistake. This is a guy who calls for transparency all the time. He could have been more transparent, and this would not be happening right now.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think part of the legs of the story is that if you're not looking at the nuances of the story, you're thinking they didn't count those as the total deaths. They did. It's dependent on where they counted them. And this is I think a point that we should go back to as a state and, you know, really look at how we're capturing data on our vital statistics, because I do think this is important. And this is where I agree with both you, both of the comments. I mean, we should understand where the sending organizations were, just not where those poor people passed. But again, I think I just want to make sure everybody understands that they were counted. It just depends on where they were counted. And you're right, Rosemary. It camouflaged where that policy went wrong.
But, you know, Andrew did the right thing. He talked about how he had taken what he considered to be the best CDC advice and also the best advice from his health commissioner. I mean, that's what you do.
All right, we're going to take
a
break.
Yeah, but that's why, what a blunder, what a political blunder, because he absolutely is right about that. There would have been sympathy for that, and he has now handed the Republicans an argument to use against him. It's so unnecessary.
We are at a
time. Unlike him. Okay,
we just have to go to a break, and then when we come back, we can go right back into arguing, I promise. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel. All right. We have a couple letters here. Excuse me. I have a tickle in my throat, and I'm trying to deal with it, and it's not going well.
Don't scratch.
Yes, that's right. That's what I want to do, but it's not working. Let's see.
Joe, you just cursed me. Now my throat feels tight. Now that you've said that, I'm like,
yeah, I'm trying to get it together here, but I'm having trouble. So I'm going to throw out an article and let you all talk about it for a second.
That's an awesome filter they just put on you.
Okay, so how about the CEOs, Jamie Dimon and other CEOs meeting with President Biden at the White House's relief plan advances. The meeting comes as House committees move forward on the $1.9 trillion pandemic relief bill. President Biden met at the White House on Tuesday with J.P. Morgan Chief Executive Jamie Dimon and other leading business executives. So what do you think, panel? Alan?
Well, you know, obviously it's smart to check in with the ruling elite in the country. I don't know where they all are in terms of pro or anti Biden, but Biden is a moderate. He always gotten along with these people, and I just think it's smart politics.
Bob?
Yeah, I think so too, Alan. I actually appreciated the fact that Biden brought people in that he knew disagreed with his policies to have conversations, and that's kind of what I expect the president to be able to do. It's not just always bringing in your partisan echo chamber, but at least given an opportunity and listen to what these folks are saying, because there are kernels of truth on both sides, and this is how difficult it is to make policy, but at least make an effort to listen and then put policies in place, not do what we've seen for the last 4 years.
Terry.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a great move. You would expect a competent president to have meetings with the leaders of some of the largest companies in the country. I think the big issue that stands out for me here is the talks about the minimum wage and raising the minimum wage, and how some of these business leaders are supportive of it, and of course others are not. And I think that's just one of the bigger challenges the president has, is to try to figure out how to deliver on that promise.
Yeah, it's huge. When you think about $15 an hour, and I'm all for it, because, you know, provides a living wage, obviously. But the downside is that, some businesses just can't afford it. It's that simple. Now, I know I'll get a letter or two saying too bad, but, different ways to look at it.
The chief executive of Gap was there. Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, was there. Marvin Ellison, chief executive of Lowe's. The head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as well as the vice president and the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, also took part in the meeting. Rosemary.
I'm having a little trouble understanding why this is news at all. It's because under Trump, these sorts of sit down and figure out what we're going to do and have all the stakeholders give their opinion. It used to be routine, and now it's so odd that this is a news story. Whether it'll do any good, I doubt it. But it's good practice for Biden, who's got to be talking to Republicans on the Hill. So he might as well deal with CEOs as well first. Good practice.
But doesn't have any impact one way or the other on the $1.9 trillion package he's trying to get passed.
I would be surprised if it does, yeah.
Bob?
Yeah. There may be something they ask for that gets put into it. I mean, it is all about the art of the compromise. I mean, I when I read the articles about this, I was heartened to see that the MyPillow dude was not still involved.
Still not included in that.
Right. So that actually, I see that as a big thumbs up plus.
Terry, you were going to say, I'm sorry.
I mean, I think it's generally helpful process to go through to getting this package passed. I mean, I think, you know, you're seeing that for the most part, these CEOs are supportive of the relief package. They want people to have money to come buy stuff. That's what they need.
Sure.
Which is why some of them have expressed interest in the minimum wage hike as well, because they understand that more money in people's pockets means more money that can be spent on the products that they sell. So I think it's a win-win for everybody at this particular moment. I think it's a good move.
All right. Let's move on to other stories if we can. And we certainly can. We have that power. We welcome your letters, of course, panel at WAMC.org. So the question about COVID testing when you go take a trip on an airplane, as the CDC waives the coronavirus testing requirement for domestic flights, who is upset about this and fiercely opposing it? Well, it would be the airline industry. No surprise there. U.S. public health officials are weighing whether to require domestic travelers to show a proof of a negative coronavirus test before boarding their flights, drawing fierce opposition from airlines, labor unions, and lawmakers, but underscoring the severity of the pandemic and difficult trade-offs involved with trying to subdue it. In an interview broadcast Sunday, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said there is an active conversation with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about whether to require coronavirus testing for domestic flights. Pressed Monday in a CNN interview on the likelihood of that happening, Buttigieg said the CDC is looking at all its options. Who would like to talk about... I'm totally putting this in your corner, Rosemary, but who would like to talk about the airline industry?
Just because the airline is opposed to it, I think this is a great idea. How much money did they take from bailout funds and from COVID relief funds from the U.S. government? And there's no reason to oppose this except because it's government regulation that supposedly will hurt their business. So do dead passengers. You can't fly if you're dead, and spreading COVID on planes and in airports, which is the only way to get on a plane. So don't tell me how safe it is on airplanes. This is a way to prevent that. And I'm someone deathly afraid of the COVID test. I don't like that whole thing up your nose. I understand it's important, but I'm not flying now either. If the test were in place, I don't know. I would certainly feel safer about the whole idea of it. I think it's certainly the government's right. I think it's certainly in the public interest to do it. And to hell with what the airlines think about it.
So, Bob Griffin, can I ask you a pesky little question that keeps coming into my mind, which is, this seems to make sense. Why weren't we doing this a year ago?
And it's also interesting to note that there doesn't seem to be much opposition to the tests for international flights. If I could lay out sort of the other side, the airline side, though, before I try to not answer the question that you just asked me.
I love when guests do that.
The airlines are always concerned about time and the perception of how difficult it is to fly. Because what happens is everything that you just said, Rosemary, is what they worry about. That you look at it and you say, you know, something between the existing security and now this security, it's just easier to drive. So this is part of their equation. So I do appreciate that. I think it, you know, someone who used to travel quite a bit, I understood, you know, the easier you can make it, the better a what is typically not a great experience anyway, it is. Now, back to your question, Joe, I just don't think either the resources or the capacity to do the testing was in place a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. And I think we're still not at where we need to be as far as our testing and our capacity to do fast testing. And frankly, if you had come to me a year ago and say this is a priority, I would have said absolutely not. It's not compared to making sure that the hospitals and the medical community and basically the rest of us have access to testing first. So I don't know if that answered. I tried to answer your question, but I also understand why the airline industry is reacting the way they are.
Right. It just seems like now testing, as we start to go with the vaccine, is that we should have been doing this all along. But that's I understand your point.
Yeah,
too.
I still blame Trump for that. We should have been further along on testing a whole lot sooner than this. So that's part of the problem too. But I'm sorry, I just have this image of TSA agents armed with nose swabs. No.
No.
Armed with nose swabs.
We think we know where you're coming from, Rosemary.
Yeah, I think so.
I know how Rosemary feels about the TSA agents. I know she has issues with the job that they do. But if they are being asked to check to see if people have concealed weapons, why is it unreasonable to ask if people are hiding the fact that they have a contagious disease that can kill people? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
I agree with you.
I haven't seen a lot of polling on this and a lot of data on this, but it seems to me, based on what I'm reading, that a lot of people, including myself, are hesitant to fly because they're worried about getting the virus. So if this will allow them to create a more safe environment that makes people feel more comfortable flying, it could actually end up helping them. So I would like to see the airlines come around and support this.
And the new information, of course, is that we have these new variants which are going to make a big difference. And so it makes sense to me. I'm not getting on an airplane, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. It's scary. Go ahead, Bob.
But part of the challenge is if you think about how tight space is at an airport, you even think about it at Albany International, where do you do it? And what do you have to take out in order to do it? So are you going to have to remove shops that are making money for you? I mean, it does come down to in part the bottom line, but it's also how difficult it is to make changes in all of the country's airports. I saw it when we were trying to introduce new technologies to be able to scan for things like explosives and guns. And there isn't an airport that is set up to do this type of screening.
So you bring a piece of paper with you, right? I mean, what am I missing here? It says you're clear.
Well, I think ideally the best way that what they're thinking about doing is there would be rapid testing right there as you board the plane. I think that's what everyone's kind of getting at. That's the same thing that our governor here in New York is talking about doing to go into Broadway theaters and to make other public venues safe. And I also think that's a good idea. So there's no reason to expect that the airlines couldn't figure out a way to do that.
Right.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who was with us and for all of you who participated this morning. Thanks, of course, Alan.
Thank you,
always
Joe.
Always a pleasure. And to Rosemary and to Terry and to Bob, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
Thanks so much.
When we come back, we will have the Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.